The state health department is investigating two confirmed cases and eight probable cases of pertussis, or whooping cough, on the island of Hawaii. It's a highly infectious bacterial disease that can be life-threatening, particularly in young children. Recommended vaccines like DTaP and TTaP prevent infection and severe outcomes, but only 87% of Hawaii's kindergartners were vaccinated with DTaP last school year. The two whooping cough cases come from separate households in different parts of the island. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Deputy State Epidemiologist Nathan Tan this morning to learn more about those cases.
I can give an update. We're investigating a cluster of two confirmed and eight probable for a total of 10 cases in two separate households on Hawaii Island. And so far, the investigation has not established any link between the clusters of cases. I think the important fact to note about these cases is that there is no travel exposure associated with any of the cases. And so that implies or indicates that these cases were likely contracted locally as opposed to out of state.
Since you haven't been able to identify a connection between these two households, they are in geographically distinct locations. What does that perhaps suggest about where they might have come from, or whether there could be more cases that haven't been identified yet?
I would say that the fact that there's no travel exposure associated with the cases indicates that there is some degree of transmission happening in the community. And this really serves as a reminder that pertussis is a condition that we have historically seen in our community. Prior to the pandemic, there was on average 45 cases of pertussis reported to the Hawaii Department of Health. It's a condition in which there's good protection and vaccination for, but it is a condition that really some degree of activity annually is to be expected.
Pre-COVID, you were saying in the 40s case-wise per year. Did you see a dip during COVID, and is the thinking now that it might be rebounding due to more in-person activity?
During the pandemic, that level of cases dropped to about 5 cases reported yearly, and that was likely due to all the mitigation measures that were put in place to control COVID. As we return to more normal activity, again, we are seeing return of pertussis and on trend to kind of return to the level that we saw historically prior to the pandemic.
In the 2022-23 school year, the kindergartner coverage for DTaP, one of the vaccines that protects against pertussis, that was 87% compared to a national average of 92.7%. And the other key fact there is that Hawaii had the largest increase in vaccination exemptions. What do those two facts have to do with one another? Why bring up the vaccination rates in this press release about these cases of whooping cough?
The vaccine does protect to a degree infection, but importantly, it protects those that are most at risk from the worst outcomes of pertussis, of whooping cough. And so having a high level of coverage for kindergartners really means that we're really protecting those that are most likely to be at risk. Vaccination for pertussis starts in the first year of life, and coverage levels in kindergarten is a reflection of how well we've done in terms of getting infants and children covered for pertussis. In terms of vaccine coverage, Hawaii historically has been at national average or above historically. In terms of exemptions, during the pandemic, for complex reasons, we did see the number of exemptions drop. In the data that you brought up, there was an increase from year over year from 2022 to 2023. But that level exemption is really similar to what we saw prior to the pandemic in terms of the level of exemptions.
Is whooping cough one of the infections that theoretically, as a community, you could reach herd immunity for? Or is the goal more along the lines of preventing severe cases, hospitalizations, and potentially deaths?
Pertussis is not really one that we talk about gaining herd immunity for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that over time the effectiveness in terms of preventing infection does decrease over time. And so talking about getting a coverage and getting a level of coverage in which we might expect no infections to be seen is not something that we really talk about. The goal of vaccination, in part, is to prevent infection, but also, most importantly, is to protect against the severest outcomes of whooping cough.
And so what are you advising families, especially families with school-age children on Hawaii Island, to be doing right now?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to make sure that children, family members are fully vaccinated through pertussis. Pertussis vaccination is a series of vaccinations. It is one of the required vaccinations for school entry. If families are unsure of their child's vaccination status for pertussis, they can talk to their medical provider. Pertussis is a reportable condition. It's a condition that providers are mandated to report to the Department of Health. And so broadly, we are in communication with the medical community to remind providers about pertussis, including obligation to report conditions. The instances of the cases of pertussis, we're in contact with the cases and any close contacts, as well as congregate settings such as schools that in which exposure might have occurred, and informing individuals in those settings about signs, what to watch for, what to do if they develop pertussis symptoms, and steps to take to prevent transmission.
What would you need to see in order to call this current cluster of cases an outbreak?
The most important thing that distinguishes these cases is that there's several cases in two different locations in which we have an established link. And so that suggests that there is some transmission happening outside of this circle or these clusters of cases. And so for the community, the important take-home point is that there is some degree of pertussis transmission that has happened in the community. This is a good time to verify that one is fully vaccinated for pertussis.
And is there anything else that you would want listeners to know about these cases or about pertussis in general?
It's important to remember how effective our vaccines are. I think given their success, it's easy to forget about the conditions that they protect us against. We really don't see, for example, children being afflicted by polio, and that's due to really effective vaccines. Similar to that, we really don't see large numbers of persons being affected by pertussis or whooping cough. It's a very devastating disease, potentially, for those that are most at risk. So these small numbers of cases are a great reminder to get vaccinated to pertussis, as well as all of the vaccine-preventable diseases. Again, we don't see these diseases because our vaccines are so effective. I can say historically, back in the 1920s, there was like 6,000 cases of whooping cough here in Hawaii. We don't see that level anymore, and that's due to the fact that the vaccine is so effective.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on and talk about these cases. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Nathan Tam, the deputy state epidemiologist, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. They were discussing the recent cases of whooping cough on the island of Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Family Charitable Fund, Dowling Company, for more than three decades working to develop housing projects for the Maui community and committed to building in balance, an HPR supporter since 2001.
You know, one of the highlights of our coverage here on Hawaii Public Radio this past year included the journey of the portrait of Hawaii's last monarch. Queen Liliuokalani was showcased at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in an exhibit that looked at the Spanish-American War, what was called the Splendid Little War, because there was relatively little bloodshed. It was entitled 1898, U.S. Imperial Visions and Revisions. It closed in February of this year, and the oil painting of the Queen returned safely home and is back on the wall at Iolani Palace. Our courage spurred many people to travel to the nation's capital to see the exhibit, including Hawaii resident Meliana Meyer. We talked with her and author and filmmaker Tom Coffin about how that exhibit has launched a weekend of a meeting of the minds around this topic. The 1898 project kicks off at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus on Saturday. Meyer starts off with what she was struck by in the exhibit.
Actually, the silence struck me, which is really interesting because you don't typically go into exhibitions wanting to hear, but I did. I wanted to hear our voices, you know, voices in resistance or voices that countered this narrative, you know, of imperialism, 1898, and I didn't hear them. I just saw a whole bunch of images of heroic, quote-unquote, men in their military uniforms painted by extraordinary painters of whom I really respect. And then ancillary materials that just didn't show Hawaiians, Guamanians, or Chamorros, and folks in the Philippines in the strongest light. In other words, our voices were very much missing in this exhibition. It was rather bloodless, given that it was a turn of events historically that really destroyed and upset many of our island nations, you know? So that's what happened when I went there in person.
And so you are going to be part of a group that is going to keep this conversation going so
Correct.
That we can talk about the things that maybe were left out in that exhibit.
Absolutely. And just the beginnings of conversation, because I think many scholars and artists are doing this kind of work or have been doing this kind of work. So this is an opportunity to bring us all together.
And so, Tom, tell us what's in store this weekend.
Oh, there's 2 days of conferencing and other kinds of sharing, including sharing food, and then we're going to have a little mini film fest on Saturday night. But it's some plenary sessions where we all discuss, and we're anticipating a couple of hundred people there at Hawaiian Study Center, and we'll have breakout panels, and we've identified the several areas that really recur and go to the top of mind, and that is militarization of all of these places and the military's or the federal government's expropriation of an enormous amount of land, prime beaches like Belos, for example, and a recurring theme across all of these places of environmental destruction, particularly disregard of water resources and abuse of water resources, the most publicized being the Red Hell debacle in on Oahu, but there are equivalents in all these other places. We're also bringing together scholars from Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam, as well as numerous scholars from Hawaii. What we found when we bring people together, making connections and the conversation immediately becomes lively. We've worked this enough that we are really anticipating what happens when we get a much larger dialogue and conversation going as we're going to this weekend.
And Meliana, when I did the early stories about this exhibit, I was excited to learn, oh, you know, will it travel? And then was very saddened to find out that, no, it wasn't going to go anywhere. You know, it was just going to stay there in D.C. And it was there for, you know, quite a while, and it did reach close to 1 million people. But, again, was saddened that that exhibit did not travel to the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam and Hawaii.
But the great part about all of this for this weekend, Catherine, is the inspiration has really caused us to get images that were open source and archival so that we could use images from the show, and we will have, you know, a couple dozen images from the exhibition that we'll be able to have around and in our discussion room so that people will get a sense of what that exhibition was like. Obviously, to have the exhibition here would have been perfect, but, you know, this is what spurred the whole conversation was that exhibition. So the fact that we are doing something in terms of having these 2 days to talk about this 1898 visions and revisions is, you know, is the start of something. So I, Tom and I thought, well, you know, it's the beginnings, and it's like anything else. So much good work has been done. So we're just adding to the the larger conversation of clarity and educating the public and others about the real history for all of these places, you know. And I think maybe that's something that we could ask you, Bob, because you were surprised when you went to the exhibition and you found some things out. If that's okay, I'd love to ask you, what moved you as a reporter and somebody from the Philippines and Guam with that kind of history?
Well, like I think I mentioned with Tom in our conversation, that I was very familiar with the Kuwe petitions that were brought by the Hawaiian people about the overthrow. But I didn't know about the petitions that Guam had sent to D.C. asking that we be able to select our own governor. You know, that we had shown our loyalty to the U.S., but we ought to be out from under the naval governors and elect our own. And then I saw, you know, I think a great-grandfather's name on that petition in the exhibit. I did go out and buy a book about the exhibit, and I was hoping that that petition would be in there. It was not. But there were other things in the book that I enjoyed. You know, the inclusion of portraits that were at the Honolulu Museum of Art recently, Landgraf's black and white portraits of the folks who said, you know, I am not American, I believe. That was the exhibit.
Right, right.
And that was pretty powerful, and I was glad they included that in here.
It was an unusual, you know, surprise. And also, this weekend, we'll have additional images from the show that people will be able to go, oh, okay, and I'll bring the catalog, and we'll have the Kuwe petition and other books that will support all of these conversations. So it'll be a lot of both.
And that was part of a conversation we had with Miliana Meyer and Tom Kaufman about the 1898 Project, which is a spinoff from an exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery entitled 1898 U.S. Imperial Visions and Revisions. We'll have more of our conversation coming up right after a break. The 1898 Project is a meeting of the minds around a political shift affecting the islands in the Pacific and the Caribbean. An exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery in D.C. that closed this past February has triggered conversations in this part of the world about the context of U.S. expansionism in our lives today. Let's get back to the conversation that we had with Miliana Meyer and Tom Kaufman. And then, Tom, you also produced a film about this point in time, and I know PBS Hawaii has rebroadcast that.
Right. The film was Nation Within, and it was actually done 25 years ago in conjunction with the 1998 100th year observance of the forced annexation. It showed widely around the country the year that I made it. PBS Hawaii has kindly taken it up again and showed it once and is in the process of showing it five more times in the next several years. So it's got a new life, and it has an overview in it, which is, it's a fair chunk of the story. It tells the story of the relationship between the takeover of Hawaii and the Spanish-American War and the mysteries of Teddy Roosevelt and the United States Navy sinking the Spanish fleet in Manila Harbor. So it is sort of a starter. I'd like to add on a different note that, you know, Melly and I started out as sort of an organization of two, but we started reaching out to a range of people, having, you know, one-on-one coffees and conversations. And wherever we turned, we found people who have really caught fire with this. And so we formed a group of conveners, we call ourselves. And by that, it's meant to say that it is like it's very open. There is no real hierarchy of decision-making or whatever. Former Governor Waihei is very active in this and is going to be a participant this weekend. Amy Agbayani, who played such an important role in developing programs for underrepresented people at the university. Dr. John Osorio, who's the Dean of Hawaiian Studies now, and which is over Native Hawaiian Student Services and the Hawaiian Study Center. Many other people have caught on with this idea. Craig Howes played a very important part at the Center for Biographical Studies, pulling everything together. So it's an idea that you know, feels like the time is really ripe for this discussion to occur. And it's way exceeded our expectations.
It's really an opportunity to have multiple conversations, particularly during these times, you know, when military leases are up and the context, I think, under which this history is set. So there's lots to learn.
Always. And can I just thank you also for your input and Dr. Willie Kawai over at Hawaiian Student Services. This is going to be at Kamakakua Kalani, the Hawaii Nuiā Kea School of Hawaiian Knowledge. So that's where all of this will be happening. And I think let's mention also Colin Moore and I think Vina Lanzona. I think that's it. That's our little group.
That's your hui. Okay.
Conveners. Yeah. It's great to do anything kākou. That's the big message, that let's do this together, find out together, and create productive answers that will help all of us. You know?
Okay. And it's all free. You don't have to register?
Nope. Okay. And dinner on Saturday night and lunch. Just come find out and get yourself educated, right?
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's very open. No registration. Starts at Hawaiian Studies Center Saturday at 1 o'clock and goes into the evening mini film festival and then starts the next day at 9, sort of 9 throughout the day. You know, in the spirit of the whole project, it's open and evolving.
That was Tom Kaufman and Meliana Meyer talking about the 1898 project that takes place this Saturday and Sunday. We will have a link to the weekend events at the University of Hawaii at Manoa campus on the conversation page of our website after the show. For today's Mono Minute, we've got the call of the pueu, Hawaii's only native owl. It's one of 10 subspecies of the short-eared owl. With the exception of Australia and Antarctica, the short-eared owl can be found on every continent and many Pacific islands. Collectively, it has one of the most extensive ranges in the avian world. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart with your Mono Minute.
Pueo, or Hawaiian short-eared owl, is our only native owl and is important in Hawaiian culture as an aumakua. Pueo are active mainly during the day, unlike the more common barn owl, which is mostly seen at night and has a striking white face. Pueo spend a majority of their time soaring over open grassy areas hunting for small mammals such as mice and rats. They're doing well on most of the Hawaiian islands, but it's becoming more difficult to hear the call of the pueo on Oahu, where they're considered an endangered subspecies. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Hakalau Forest National Wildlife Refuge, committed to helping preserve, protect, and restore the biological diversity of Hawaii Island. Friendsofhakalauforest.org.
Did you know this happens to be Pickleball Month? We recently brought you a whole week of pickleball stories, and we just talked to Kaiser Permanente Hawaii's sports medicine doctor, Benjamin Chun, about the rise of injuries as more and more people take up the sport. Here's Chun with the lowdown on pickleball pain.
So our practice kind of sees all ages. So we've definitely seen more people participating. So just talking about it, because every time someone comes in, we kind of ask, well, what are you doing these days? What are you doing for exercise? What are you kind of into as far as like recreational activity? And the pickleball keeps coming up more and more and more and more for people. So we're definitely seeing an increase in interest in participating. And then with that, we're having people have more issues who are playing pickleball, having more issues with various kinds of injuries. Typically, the stuff we're seeing is what's kind of out there in the literature, which is the common thing. So the most common joint to come in and see us in the office is the knee. And then the second most common joint that we probably see is going to be the shoulder. And I'd say pickleball people, it's kind of the same distribution of that. So most of the knee issues that we see, I'd say we see probably less acute injuries, and it's more kind of like exacerbation of underlying things, mostly osteoarthritis or degenerative meniscus tears. We'll see some newer stuff, which is usually like new to participation. So that's going to be like your overuse tendonitis, so runner's knee or patellofemoral syndrome, some IT band syndrome stuff for the knee. Shoulders is typically more overuse as opposed to like acute injury. So that's going to be more of your rotator cuff tendonitis type stuff and impingement syndromes. We are not the ER though, so I've heard from ER colleagues that they are seeing a little bit more like the traumatic injuries. So ER is where they're going to see like the wrist fractures from the falls. That's kind of more commonplace with pickleball athletes, and the ankle sprain type things.
Well, explain something to me, because we often hear of tennis elbow or golf knee, but I don't know, do they have a name for pickleball something or other?
So I have seen they're sort of stealing, like, I don't want to get into all the angry politics of tennis versus pickleball. I'd hate to have pickleball steal another term for the pickleball elbow, which is basically tennis elbow. You'd see that because the paddle can be a little bit heavier for some folks, and it does make a difference, like, how heavy the paddle is that they're using. So sometimes people get one that's a little bit too heavy, and they end up getting like the classic quote-unquote tennis elbow.
Well, I heard a new one. A coworker said that a friend of hers gave herself a black eye with the paddle.
The more people play, the more they come up with like new and exciting ways to injure themselves.
Well, we do hear of a number of people, our kapuna, right, that are taking up the sport because, you know, you don't have to run as far, right? The court's smaller. But I imagine, yeah, the falls and broken bones probably you're seeing.
Luckily, we haven't seen like an epidemic of that, thankfully. We do know that there's a risk of falls, and we certainly have seen our fair share of people falling and getting contusions to knees. The wrist fracture thing, I think, is the thing we worry a little bit most about, because usually it's kind of the person either trying to backpedal really quickly and then kind of losing their balance, or they're not used to kind of turning and running really fast. And so they lose balance and then they fall and they kind of put their hands out to try and break their fall, and they land on their hands and knees. And then usually the biggest concern with that is that they're going to break their wrist. So that is definitely, in our older athlete, one of the concerns about them playing.
And then correct me if I'm wrong. So if you injure your wrist, is that more like an occupational injury versus where you go to occupational therapy versus physical therapy?
Dealing with like hand-wrist issues, usually it's occupational therapy because they do hand therapy. But yeah, the hope is that you don't have a wrist injury that requires a surgery. But at the very least, it's a lot of time down from your participating in your sport and your exercise while you're healing up. And so we like to have people able to continue being active and out there and not kind of losing time due to injury.
Well, I mean, it's great. If it's getting you off the couch and away from the television or computer and getting you outside and active, I mean, that's a plus.
Absolutely. So even though like we see more injuries related to pickleball participation, we don't view it as a bad thing. We're just happy to see people getting excited about stuff, because at least half the people that are going to pickleball used to be doing something else, and they kind of got away from doing regular exercise because maybe they developed a little arthritis and it was harder to play tennis or it was harder to play racquetball. And they said, you know, my friend told me to come out. I can still compete. I can socialize. I can get out there and kind of get back in the saddle of doing regular exercise again, but it doesn't have the same burden and impact on my body, so I'm able to do this stuff. So we've definitely seen people kind of reigniting that excitement to get back out and play sports again, which is great, because that just helps every other health maintenance thing that they have. So selfishly, our population that goes out there and plays pickleball is just much healthier overall, right? They just have better blood pressure control, better diabetes management. They're more engaged in kind of staying healthy. So across the board, always a net benefit to be out there.
Well, is there anything you want to say about prevention? You know, we often hear about stretching, you know, that kind of warming up.
Probably the best message is, number one, we definitely encourage people pursuing their interests and passions. Like the data, there's not a ton of data out there on like injuries and things for pickleball, but we do know that participation in pickleball is a net benefit to someone's health and well-being. So that's number one. So just if you're interested, we definitely encourage you pursuing that. But with that, we like people to be conscientious and aware of the things that they're bringing there to the pickleball court. So if they have arthritis, or they have mobility issues, or they have a little bit of balance problems, not kind of recklessly flinging themselves out there, but saying, hey, you know, I'm older now, I'm wiser, I'm going to be a little bit more strategic about how I go out, so I'm going to kind of ease into this. So I kind of want to feel it out. I want to first make sure I have the proper shoes. I want court shoes, something that's comfortable, that's not going to slip on me. I want to make sure I have the right equipment. And then I'm going to feel out, well, how do I move now, right? So I've been, even if I've been jogging and staying in shape, I've been doing a lot of straight ahead stuff. I haven't necessarily been doing side to side things. So I want to see, well, how does everything move? Like, do I feel stiff moving in certain ways? Am I a little unbalanced moving in certain ways? Do I have the right shoulder mobility? So as I kind of assess myself, I want to see realistically what's the best way to do this. Do I join a class first and I kind of work my way up? Do I start getting myself on a regular exercise regimen to support the pickleball? So I start stretching more regularly. I start doing more dynamic warm-ups. I start going for walks more regularly to get my strength back. Do I join a gym again just to make myself feel like I can handle the competitive demand out there? So, and then being honest with yourself and listening to your body always. And so what we tell people is, if your body says, I'm hurting, maybe I'm not ready for this right now, it doesn't mean that I can't be ready for it and I should never do this. It just means I'm not ready for that thing yet. So I'm going to start laying my foundation. I'm going to start doing regular exercise and training. And once I get to this step, I can move up to the next one. So encouraging them, but being mindful of, like, being honest with themselves about where are my limitations and what do I need to do to address those.
Yeah, I'm 65. Do I need to get limber first, start with walks, start with some weight-bearing exercises, that kind of thing, just to get your stamina up? You are going to be shifting around on the court.
Sure, but it's okay to go with your friends or your family members and, like, play around with the paddle and the ball, see if you like it. Kind of get into that environment where, you know, one of the biggest benefits is it's such a community thing. So you feel engaged, you know, people are encouraging, and you just feel it out there, right? So not feeling like you have to kind of peek over the fence and be wistful for what other people are doing without you, but just going out there and kind of feeling it out and just seeing, like, how do I feel about this? And just assessing where you're at. You know, am I ready to start being competitive and at what level? You know, most people start with doubles because it's a little bit easier in the body first, and you get to learn the rules of the game and the pace of the play.
The pace of the play. That was Kaiser Permanente Hawaii sports medicine doctor Benjamin Chun talking to us about the types of injuries that he's seeing with the rise of pickleball. Its popularity was high before the pandemic and only intensified during and after.